Good evening and welcome to Kadampa Center. It's wonderful to see so many people here this evening. And I see quite a few new faces. I know several of you have come in from out of town just to see Venerable Children. So an announcement first for our regulars. A reminder that Geshe-la requests that we do prostrations with him when he teaches. But traditionally, it's actually you wait until the teacher does three prostrations, and then you prostrate as the teacher steps onto the throne. So we do it differently, especially at Geshe-la's request. So it may be your habit to prostrate with the teacher, but you'll want to wait. And then for everyone, and especially those out-of-towners, if you have a burning question and you'd like to request a private meeting with Venerable Children, that is a possibility. You would just need to come talk to me and we can see if that can be arranged. There's very limited time, though, because when she's not teaching, she's also doing prison visits. So her schedule's very full. So please be respectful, and it's not really a chat. It's if you have a true burning Dharma question, she would be happy to meet with you. Thank you. She should be here in just a few minutes.
So we'll be saying prayers from this gold book, starting with the first prayer, which is on, I think, page 3. But before we do, I'd like to mention our sponsors, Danny McCracken, to Andre and Rebecca, who have shown me the importance of living the Dharma every day, Brian Uslick, in the snowy mountain paradise, you're the source of good and happiness, powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezig, may you stay until samsara ends. And Daniel Dimitrov, to the long life and good health of His Holiness, may quickly and more quickly return to the land of snows, and may the Tibetan people be free to practice the Dharma in their home land with no fear or hindrances whatsoever, to establishing the Bhikshuni lineage in the Tibetan tradition, and finally I dedicate that I may find meaningful livelihood which will most benefit others. So we'll say the praise to the Shakyamuni Buddha, and we'll say this first prayer that starts with to the founder just one time. To the founder, the endowed transcendent destroyer, the one gone beyond, the foe destroyer, the completely perfected, fully awakened being, perfect in knowledge and in good conduct, Sugata, know of the world, supreme guide of human beings to be tamed, teacher of gods and human beings, to you, the completely and fully awakened one, the endowed transcendent destroyer, the glorious conqueror, the subduer from the Shakya clan, I prostrate, make offerings, and go for refuge. When, O supreme amongst humans, you were born on this earth, you paced out 7 strides, then said, I am supreme in this world. To you who are wise then, I prostrate. With pure bodies, form supremely pure, wisdom motion like a golden mountain, fame that blazes in the 3 worlds, winner of the best, Lord, to you I prostrate. With the supreme signs, face like spotless moon, color like gold, to you I prostrate. Just free like you, the 3 worlds are not, incomparably wise, to you I prostrate. The Savior having great compassion, the Founder having all understanding, the field of merit with qualities like a vast ocean, to you, the one gone to thusness, I prostrate. The purity that frees one from attachment, the virtue that frees one from the lower realms, the one path, the sublime, pure reality, to the Dharma that pacifies, I prostrate. Those who are liberated and who also show the path to liberation, the holy field qualified with realizations, who are devoted to the moral precepts, to you, the sublime community intending virtue, I prostrate. Homage to the Supreme Buddha, homage to the Dharma refuge, homage to the great Sangha, to all 3 ever devout homage, to all worthy of respect, bowing with bodies as many as all realms, atoms, and all aspects, with supreme faith I pay homage. Do not commit any virtuous actions, perform only perfect virtuous actions, subdue your mind thoroughly. This is the teaching of the Buddha. A star, a visual aberration, a flame of a lamp, an illusion, a drop of dew or a bubble, a dream, a flash of lightning, a cloud, see conditioned things as such. Through these merits may sentient beings attain the rank of all seeing, subdue the foe of faults, and be delivered from samsara's ocean, perturbed by the waves of aging, sickness, and death. And then we'll do the Heart Sutra, starting on the middle of page 8 in English. I prostrate to the Arya Triple Gem. Thus did I hear at one time. The Bhagavan was dwelling on massive Vultures Mountain in Raja Griha, together with a great community of monks and a great community of bodhisattvas. At that time, the Bhagavan was absorbed in the concentration on the categories of phenomena called profound perception. Also at that time, the bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara looked upon the very practice of the profound perfection of wisdom and beheld those five aggregates also as empty of inherent nature. Then through the power of Buddha, the Venerable Shariputra said this to the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara. How should any son of the lineage train who wishes to practice the activity of the profound perfection of wisdom? He said that, and the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara said this to the Venerable Shariputra. Shariputra, any son of the lineage or daughter of the lineage who wishes to practice the activity of the profound perfection of wisdom should look upon it like this, correctly and repeatedly, beholding those five aggregates also as empty of inherent nature. Form is empty, emptiness is form. Emptiness is not other than form. Form is also not other than emptiness. In the same way, feeling, discrimination, compositional factors, and consciousness are empty. Shariputra, likewise, all phenomena are emptiness, without characteristic, unproduced, unceased, stainless, not without stain, not deficient, not fulfilled. Shariputra, therefore, in emptiness there is no form, no feeling, no discrimination, no compositional factors, no consciousness, no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no visual form, no sound, no odor, no taste, no object of touch, and no phenomenon. There is no eye element, and so on up to and including no mind element and no mental consciousness element. There is no ignorance, no extinction of ignorance, and so on up to and including no aging and death, and no extinction of aging and death. Similarly, there is no suffering, origination, cessation, and path. There is no exalted wisdom, no attainment, and also no non-attainment. Shariputra, therefore, because there is no attainment, bodhisattvas rely on and dwell in the perfection of wisdom, the mind without obscuration and without fear. Having completely passed beyond error, they reach the end point of nirvana. All the Buddhas who dwell in the three times also manifestly completely awaken to unsurpassable, perfect, complete enlightenment in reliance on the perfection of wisdom. Therefore, the mantra of the perfection of wisdom, the mantra of great knowledge, the unsurpassed mantra, the mantra equal to the unequal, the mantra that thoroughly pacifies all suffering, should be known as truth since it is not false. The mantra of the perfection of wisdom is declared. Tayata om gate gate para gate para sam gate bodhisoha. Shariputra, the bodhisattva, mahasattva, should train in the profound perfection of wisdom like that. Then the Bhagavan arose from that concentration and commended the bodhisattva, mahasattva, Arya Avalokiteshvara, saying, well said, son of the lineage, it is like that, it is like that. One should practice profound perfection of wisdom, just as you have indicated. Even the Tathagatas rejoice. The Bhagavan, having thus spoken, the Venerable Shariputra, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara, those surrounding in their entirety, along with the world of gods, humans, asuras, and Gandharvas, were overjoyed and highly praised that spoken by the Bhagavan.
So let's generate our motivation and breath by breath. Really appreciate being alive, appreciate having this opportunity and the time to encounter the Dharma, to study it, to practice it. And let's have a strong resolve to make our life very meaningful for however long it lasts. And the best way to do this is to generate the bodhicitta aspiration based on impartial love and compassion for all beings. Then wanting to get involved in improving their situation and seeing that attaining full awakening is the best way to do that, then having the aspiration for full awakening. And so let's make that our long-term motivation for sharing the Dharma together this evening. I feel like the lady from Mars, and I probably look like her too. Okay, so I was asked to talk about the Four Noble Truths, which are the foundation of the Buddha's teachings and the foundation of all the different Buddhist traditions, the teachings found in the Theravada or the Pali tradition, in Chan or Zen, in Hua Yin, in Tibetan Buddhism. Everybody traces whatever practice they do back to the Four Noble Truths. So if we learn the Four Noble Truths well, then we have a very good understanding of the Dharma. Some of you have also studied the Lam Rim, so you've heard the teachings expressed in terms of the beings of the three capacities. So it's interesting to think of, you know, what's the relationship between the teachings of the beings of three capacities and the Four Noble Truths. Yeah, because there's also a way of describing the teachings for each of the three capacity beings in as their own, quote-unquote, Four Noble Truths. In other words, what suffering, what dukkha is, what its origin, and what is the cessation in the path. But maybe we'll get into that a little bit later. So in talking about the Four Noble Truths, there's a little bit of translation stuff that we have to talk about first. First of all, the translation, the Four Noble Truths, is not a very good one. Because people say, what's noble about suffering? And also the word suffering isn't a good translation. So here what noble means, it refers to Arya beings, those who have realized the nature of reality directly. And so these are four facts that the Arya beings see as true. Okay, so it doesn't mean that suffering is noble. That's kind of strange sounding, doesn't it? You know, or that the cause, that ignorance is noble because it's the cause of suffering. You know, it just means four things that are seen as true by noble beings who realize emptiness directly. So the four, they're commonly translated as dukkha, as suffering, origin, cessation, and path. The first one, suffering, horrible translation. I think we should really abolish it because although everybody's familiar with it, it's extremely misleading. Yeah, because when we hear the word suffering in English, what do we think about? You know, I'm in pain. Yeah, that's not the meaning of the Sanskrit and Pali word dukkha. Okay, dukkha, which I will use instead of the word suffering, refers to unsatisfactory. It means unsatisfactory. Yeah. So there's three levels on which things are unsatisfactory. One is that some things are painful. Okay. We can't say everything is painful, can we? Because everything's not painful. And in this way, this is how Buddhism sometimes gets a bad rap because of these weird translations. I went to a college class once, and the student raised their hand and they said, Buddha said life is suffering. So what's the use? Well, yeah, if it's translated like that, it sounds pretty weird. The Buddha didn't say life is suffering. The The Buddha said our conditions in cyclic existence are unsatisfactory. Okay, but we're not in overt pain all the time, are we? Okay, so overt pain is one level of how things in cyclic existence are unsatisfactory. Another level is what we call the unsatisfactoriness or the dukkha of change, that whatever pleasure we get doesn't last for a long time. And in fact, whatever pleasure we have is kind of something painful, but when it's still small, okay, in the sense that when, okay, right now you feel good sitting down, right? Yeah? Well, after a couple of hours, how are you going to feel? Yeah, I want this lady to be quiet because I want to stand up. Okay, so you stand up finally. Oh, I get to stand up. And your feeling is, oh, pleasure. But when you keep standing up for a long time, then what happens? Then the initial pleasure you had doesn't last, and actually things become painful. Okay, so this is what is meant by the unsatisfactoriness of change, because whatever situation we put ourselves in, it might seem pleasurable at the beginning, but if we do it long enough, it becomes actually painful. Yeah. So if you think of the kind of bestest pleasure you've had in cyclic existence, yeah, and then you imagine having that 24/7, then what happens? Yeah? Like maybe you had a good meal and you keep eating and eating and eating and eating, and then what happens? Okay, so we can see that eating itself is not the cause of pleasure, because if you keep doing it after a certain point, it becomes painful. Yeah? You fall in love. Yeah, Prince Charming, he showed up finally. Yeah, he's a little bit late, but better late than never. Yeah, so initially Prince Charming is just fantastic, you know. Better than sliced bread, as they say. But if you're with Prince Charming 24/7, what happens? Can I have a break? You know, it's like, go do something else. Leave me alone for a while. You know, so that experience that was so wonderful just becomes, after a while, intolerable. Yeah, so that's another level of dukkha. And then the third level is what's called the dukkha of pervasive conditioning. And this means that just being under the influence of afflictions and karma. Yeah. Just the fact that our lives are governed by our ignorance that misapprehends reality. You know, and that this ignorance gives birth to all sorts of other afflictions like clinging and jealousy and greed, yeah, arrogance. And then through these kinds of mental afflictions, then we also create karma. So, you know, just, and then that karma ripens in us taking rebirth again and again and again. Yeah. And so just the fact that we aren't really free. Okay. Now, we Americans think we're free, don't we? We have the, maybe we could call it the conceit of freedom. We think we're really free. In other words, we're free to follow every foolish, ridiculous thought that enters our mind. Yeah. Is that freedom? That's captivity, isn't it? That's captivity. Our minds are not free. No? A thought enters the mind, and, you know, we go, oh, that sounds good. No? I mean, look at these two brothers with their, you know, setting off the bomb in Boston. This thought entered their mind, and they thought, yeah, that sounds interesting. Why not? And look what happened. Now, our thoughts may not lead to things like that, but we all have our own stupidagios, don't we? You know, these thoughts that come in our mind, and then we just follow them out and wind up in big messes. Yeah? Have you ever kind of gone along in your life, and then you reach some point and you go, wait a minute, how come I'm in this situation? How did I get here? Yeah, I don't want to be in this situation. How did I get here? Have you ever had that happen to you? Yeah? Well, how did we get there? Ignorance, afflictions. And then we made certain choices and decisions, yeah, that were foolish. And there we are in the middle of situations we don't want to be in. Okay? So all of this is what's meant by the dukkha of pervasive conditioning. Okay? So that's kind of the short rundown of what true dukkha, the first of the Four Noble Truths, is. But what I wanted to do, because I'm sure in other, you know, you've heard, many of you have heard these teachings before, is I wanted to go into a little bit more depth talking about the 16 aspects of the Four Noble Truths, because that isn't always explained so much, although sometimes it is. So in the Tibetan teachings, the 16 aspects of the Four Noble Truths is rooted in an explanation by Vasubandhu in the Abhidharmakosha and by Dharmakirti in his Pramavartika. Okay, and then what's interesting, in the Pali tradition, they also have the 16 aspects of the Four Noble Truths, but they're different. And the source commentary is different. And so I was thinking, if we have time, then I might go through the 16 from the Pali tradition too, because it's quite interesting to see, you know, the difference and the similarities. Okay. So, and before I go any further, yeah, so we have the four, true dukkha, yeah, the cause of dukkha, the cessation, and then the path. Yeah, so the cessation of dukkha and its causes, the path leading to that cessation. Now, most of us, when we come to Buddhism, you know, the first thing that we hear about is dukkha, unsatisfactoriness, and we go, oh. Yeah, don't we? It's like, I don't want to hear about unsatisfactoriness. I live in the middle of unsatisfactoriness. I want to hear about light and love and bliss. I want to be inspired and float on the clouds and like this. But that's not the first teaching the Buddha gave. Yeah, the first teaching was this one on the Four Noble Truths, and the first thing he taught was true dukkha. He didn't teach light and love and bliss. Okay, so why did he do that? Yeah, wouldn't he have been more popular teaching light and love and bliss? Yeah, didn't he know that we Americans are looking for that? Because the Buddha wants us to really look very clearly at what our situation is. You know, this is one thing that really attracted me to the Dharma from the very beginning, is that you have to be really honest. You know, if you're going to practice, you have to be honest. You have to be honest with yourself. Yeah. And our ego tries every which way to get out of looking at something, you know, and to justify and rationalize and resist. But eventually, we just have to be honest. So the first thing we have to be honest about is the nature of our existence and that it's unsatisfactory. And many of us, we would rather not look at that. Like I said, you know, we think, I live in the middle of it. Please don't explain it to me. Yeah? But that's the whole point, that we need to see our situation very clearly for what it is, so that we will generate the aspiration to get out of it. If we don't see it clearly, we won't really aspire for liberation. And this is part of our problem, is that we kind of like our cyclic existence, our samsara, don't we? You know, it's like, yeah, I like the shopping mall, I have a good sex life. Well, you do, I don't. But, you know, there's nice food, those movies, you know, this is kind of, you know, so yeah, so I want this. But then I also want some kind of transcendental experience, you know, the light, love, and bliss stuff. And I want to have both of them at the same time. I don't want to really give up my chocolate cake. Yeah. So, when we have that attitude, it's because we don't clearly understand what our circumstances are. We haven't been totally honest with ourselves about our situation. Okay? Because it's kind of scary to be really honest. It's scary to our ego. It's relief to our wisdom mind, but it's scary to our ego. Mm-hmm. So the Buddha is saying, look, you have to really look at your situation very clearly, and you have to look at what causes it, and see how all of this is functioning moment by moment in your life. And to be able to look at it and say, I don't want to continue in this way. I want out. I want real freedom. And then when we want real freedom, then to hear about nirvana or true cessation and the path leading to it, then we have a lot of energy to practice the path and attain nirvana. But as long as we kind of think our cyclic existence, our samsara is kind of nice, then, you know, our practice doesn't become totally heartfelt. Do you know what I mean? Yeah? Do you know what I mean? It's like, why can't we get ourselves to the meditation cushion in the morning? How many of you have problems getting to the cushion in the morning? Yeah, this kind of, yeah? It's hard to get yourself to the cushion in the morning. Why? Yeah. If your hair were on fire, would it be hard to get in the shower to put the fire out? No. You wouldn't lie in bed and say, I'll do it tomorrow morning. Yeah. Because you see the pain. Yeah. And you see what's going to happen if you don't stick your head in a bucket of water and get that fire out. But with our samsara, which is actually a worse condition than having our hair on fire, we don't really see it as something that bad. Yeah? And so, well, getting out, you know, kind of, yeah, I'll get around to it later. I'm enjoying life right now. Yeah. And so for that reason, then it's hard to get to the cushion in the morning. We'd much rather sleep an extra half hour or, you know, read the newspaper. Yeah, we'd much rather read about war and exploitation and everything in the newspaper than sit down and meditate. It's crazy, isn't it? So this thing of really facing our situation is why the Buddha taught dukkha and its origins, the beginning. Yeah? Okay, so let's get into a little bit more depth about these. Get my glasses. They shrink the print every year. Have you noticed that? I remember when I could read 12 point font. And then they shrunk it. Okay. So, when we talk about the 16 aspects, there's four for each of the four noble truths. Okay, so the true dukkha has four aspects. And when we talk about these four aspects, the example that we're going to use are our five aggregates. Yeah, our body and mind are the example of the that we use to look at these four attributes. So the five aggregates, okay, our body, first of all, we know what that one is, yeah. And then there's four mental aggregates. One is feelings, so that's feelings of pleasure, pain, neutral. Next one is discrimination, the ability to discern what different things are. The next one, it's called compositional factors, which is a term that tells you nothing. Yeah, but what it refers to is everything that's not the other three mental ones. So that's why the term tells you nothing. What it includes is like all of our emotions and then just different mental factors that help cognition occur. But all of our emotions are included in what they call compositional factors or volitional factors. It's another translation. And then consciousness is the fifth aggregate. And this applies to primary consciousness that just sees, you know, objects of sight, audible objects, smellable objects, tasteable objects, touchable objects, and mental objects. Okay, so those are the five aggregates are what constitute the person. In other words, in dependence upon these five, you know, the body and then the mind, which is the other four, then we label person, we label I or you or he or she or it. Okay? So, the first of the 16 is the polluted aggregates are impermanent because they undergo continuous momentary arising and disintegration. So here when we say polluted aggregates, it means our body and mind that's under the influence of ignorance, mental afflictions, and then the polluted karma, the polluted actions that we do. Yeah. And so our body and mind, our present body and mind, are impermanent. Yeah. Here, impermanent means momentary. They change moment by moment. Yeah. It doesn't mean permanent and impermanent doesn't mean eternal and non-eternal. It just means, you know, either changing moment by moment or not changing moment by moment. And why are they impermanent? Because they undergo, continuous momentary arising and disintegration. So, even from a scientific viewpoint, if we think of our body is changing every single nanosecond, isn't it? Yeah. We can't see it. And we feel like this body is unchanging. It's the same thing. But science even tells us that, you know, the electrons are whirling around and the protons are moving and the neutrons are bubbling and all the other quarks and different things are, everything is changing moment by moment. Yeah, true? Yeah, very true, isn't it? So, on a very small level, everything is changing moment by moment. And so because of that, on a gross level, everything's changing moment by moment too. But what's strange is when we look at things on the gross level, everything looks quite stable, doesn't it? You know, we look at the table, and this is the same table that was here yesterday. Yeah, when you look at it, those of you who were here last night or last week, it's the same table. Nothing's changed about it. It's just there. And, you know, my body, nothing's changed about it. It's the same body. And that's the way things appear to us, as if they're static. But all we have to do is reflect a moment, and we see, well, no, actually the table, on a microscopic level, everything has been changing the whole time. Yeah? And our body, everything's been changing the whole time, hasn't it? We've eaten different food, we've excreted different things, we've sweated, new things have come into our body, new things have gone out of our body. Yeah, changing moment by moment. And on a mental level too, our mind is changing all the time, isn't it? We feel like, well, no, I'm just me. I think, you know, I have the same ideas and opinions and personality as yesterday. Wrong. Yeah. We're not the same person as we were yesterday, are we? We're different. We've had different experiences in the last 24 hours. There's a continuity with who we were yesterday. But in fact, moment by moment, there's been change from yesterday to today. So even though everything looks to us and appears to us to be quite stable and steady and predictable, actually, it's not. It's changing all the time. And nothing, and it changes by its very nature. Yeah. So things come into, at the same time something is coming into existence, it is simultaneously going out of existence. Yeah. Now our mind says, well, wait. Okay. First there's the past, then there's the present, then there's the future. This is the way we think. So in the past, something arose. Then in the present, it stays stable. Then in the future, it declines. It disintegrates. That's the way we think, right? Okay. Exactly when is the present? Can you isolate the present moment? The only time we ever live is the present. But when exactly is the present? And can you find the present? So when something is arising, it's arising in the present, isn't it? But that present moment is also disintegrating at the same time it's arising. And it's arising and disintegrating by its own nature. You don't need another cause to come in and make a change. It's not like something arises and then it's permanent for a while. And then another cause come in and goes, boom, now you're going to disintegrate, and it goes crash. It's not like that. At the very same present moment that something is arising, it's also disintegrating. At the time it is coming into existence, it's also going out of existence. When we look at a very minute level. Yeah. So it's quite interesting in our meditation to try and figure out exactly when the present moment is. And when is something arising? And when is it abiding? And when is it disintegrating? Okay, so you can sit with that in your meditation a little bit. It's quite interesting. Okay, so everything is in this momentary flux. And in that way, it's quite insubstantial. Now, our senses are deceptive. They, you know, our senses can't detect that subtle change. So we think everything, you know, is the same. You know, it's like, even in a gross way, how, you know, planet Earth is turning around and whizzing through space. And yet we feel like everything's standing still, don't we? We don't feel like we're whizzing through space. But in fact, we are. Yeah? So there's a disconnect between how our gross senses are perceiving things and how things really exist. Yeah? So one of the distortions we have that keeps us quite bound in cyclic existence is that we see things that are in fact momentary and impermanent by nature as static, as unchanging. And that misperception, that misconception or misapprehension leads us to have a lot of problems. Because we assume everything is stable and non-changing. And then when it changes, we freak out. Yeah? You get a new car. Here's my new car. Stable, permanent, gorgeous, unchanging. And then somebody scratches it. And you go, how did that happen? Yeah, that wasn't supposed to happen. Yeah, that's breaking the rules of the universe. My new car is not supposed to get dented or scratched the day after I buy it. Okay, and we get very upset and we get angry. And it's all rooted in our thinking that our car is static and unchanging and unscratchable. Undentable. I mean, we can see the same way when somebody dies, how shocked we are. Even we know somebody is terminally ill. Yeah, even we know, even we go to the hospital day after day and see them declining. On the day they die, we go, what happened? This isn't supposed to happen. Yeah? You've had that experience? Yeah, it's like, wait a minute. I knew they were dying, but they weren't supposed to die. Yeah? They were just going to stay in this dying situation forever. They weren't supposed to be dead. Yeah? And we kind of freak out. So again and again, if we look, the times when we are emotionally upset, very often it's because something's changed that we didn't expect to change. Yeah, we expected it to be fixed, permanent, predictable. And lo and behold, it changed. And we reject the reality of the change. And that's what our anger and upset and grief is about. It's like, no, I refuse to accept this change. Yeah. This relationship is not going to break up. It's not supposed to break up. My car is not supposed to get dented. Spaghetti sauce is not supposed to be on my white new carpeting. Yeah. My mother is not supposed to die. Yeah. My child is fixed at this age. Oh my God, a teenager forever? There, that's when you want impermanence. You know, it's like, get them out of their teenage years. But, you know, we look at things, everything's fixed. And then it changes and we go, what happened? It wasn't supposed to. Yeah. Have you ever looked in the mirror and gone, who is that person? Yeah? It's like, wait a minute. Yesterday I had brown hair. You know, how come today it's white? Yeah, yesterday the skin didn't look like this. There weren't so many wrinkles. How come today it's like this? Yeah. We're surprised. And yet, moment by moment, the aging process is going on. Okay? So that's the first of the 16 aspects. Yeah? So our body and mind are momentary. The second one, the polluted aggregates are unsatisfactory. They're dukkha. Yeah. Because they are under the control of afflictions and karma. Okay? So here, dukkha refers to the three kinds of dukkha I explained at the beginning, of pain, of change, and then the dukkha of pervasive conditioning. Okay, so those three that I explained. And they, you know, our aggregates are unsatisfactory because they're under the control of afflictions and karma. So we experience these three kinds of dukkha because of our ignorance, which gives rise to the afflictions, which give rise to the karma. So I want to talk a little bit about that, because this is an important kind of sequence for us to get. So when we hear the word ignorance, in Buddhism it means something very, very particular. Okay. It doesn't mean the ignorance of voting for the wrong political party. Dare I mention who that is? I better not. Yeah, so it's not referring to that kind of ignorance. Yeah. Here, it's referring to an ignorance that misapprehends how things exist. So whereas things arise dependent on causes and conditions, right? Yeah, things depend on causes and conditions. Whereas they depend on parts. Everything has parts. And whereas they also depend on the mind that's perceiving them. Yeah? That puts the parts together and conceives of some kind of object and gives it a name. So whereas things are dependent in their very nature, ignorance apprehends them as having an independent nature that doesn't depend on any other factors. Okay. So, for example, when you look at the flower, yeah, do you look at the flower and think, does it automatically appear to your mind and you think, this arose due to a seed and light and soil and rain? Does that appear to your mind when you see the flower? Do you think about that when you see the flower? No. Okay. It looks like it's a flower out there, independent of everything. Of course, we know it arose from a seed and sunlight and those things. We know that intellectually. But our gut feeling is, well, it's just there. Okay. When you look at the flower, do you think, oh, it depends on parts? Yeah? Do you look at it and say, oh, this is just a combination of petals and pistils and stamens and... Yeah? Do you think that when you look at the flower? Do you look at the flower and say, this is just a combination of oxygen and carbon and nitrogen? And... No, it's a flower. Independent there, right? Yeah. When we see the flower, do we think, oh, that flower depends on my mind putting all those petals together, mentally putting the petals together and conceiving of it as one object? Or do we think of it as a flower having the nature of flowerness radiating out from its own side? Yeah.
When you look at a person, do you think of another person as a collection of parts? No. It looks like there's a person inside there from their own side. Yeah. So this is ignorance. Okay. That ignorance misapprehends things and thinks they have their own nature independent from their own side. But when we just examine a little bit, we see that nothing actually exists that way. That everything that exists, exists dependent on other factors. Yeah? You following me? Yeah? So, because of this ignorance, yeah, this is the fundamental ignorance. We call it the ignorance grasping inherent existence, the ignorance grasping true existence, or the self-grasping ignorance. Yeah, a bunch of different names for it, okay? But based on that, you know, fundamental misapprehension, especially of I, who we are, you know, I mean, do you, when you think I, you know, sit there and say me, say your name for a minute, you know, whatever your name is. Do you think, oh, I am dependent on other things? Yeah. Or do you think, I'm here and I'm in control? Yeah. Which way do you think of yourself? Do you think I exist only because the causes of me exist? No, forget causes. I'm here. Yeah, forget conditions. I'm here. I am real. Yeah. It's true, isn't it? It appears like there's this me somewhere here. We're not quite, you know, that's in control and wants happiness and doesn't want suffering and is going to get my happiness and get rid of everything that makes me suffer. Okay? And so from that, we get attachment. We get anger. There's a real me. So this real me needs to be protected. Yeah? I need to protect me. I need to give me pleasure. So I want this, and I want this, and I want this, and I want this. Okay? So I get attached to different things. Yeah. And I do all sorts of stuff to get the things that I want. Sometimes I may lie. Sometimes I may steal. Right? Yeah? Sometimes I, you know, badmouth somebody to get what I want or to protect what I have. And if somebody gets in my way of getting what I want or takes away my happiness, I am enraged. And when I am kicked off, beware. You know, I will call you every name in the book. I will lie. I will scream. I will blame, ridicule, humiliate. You know, beat you up, throw things at you. Yeah, do whatever I can to hurt you. Because you're interfering with my happiness. Now you may say, well, she's exaggerating. I'm not that bad. Check up. Yeah? We can be pretty nasty. Of course, we sugarcoat our nastiness. Yeah? We make it look like actually we're right. And the other person deserved it. And we're doing it for out of compassion for them. Yeah? You know, this person at work who got the promotion that I'm very jealous of, you know, he's so arrogant, and his arrogance is really going to hurt him. So he needs somebody to kind of, you know, bring him down a notch or two for his own good. So out of compassion, I'm going to say all these horrible, nasty things about him behind his back because he got in the way of my happiness, this idiot. But, you know, it's all for his benefit and, you know, I'm not that bad. Right?
Yeah? Okay. So from ignorance, then we get, you know, the clinging attachment. We get the anger, jealousy, arrogance, you know, all of these, you know, lovely emotions that cause us so much misery. And then, due to those emotions, these disturbing emotions, then we do actions, you know, the lying and stealing and sleeping around and this and that and the other thing. Okay? And then we wonder why we have problems. Yeah? Why do I have problems? Why don't people like me? I'm such a nice, sweet, adorable, lovable person, you know? And I just tell people off when they need it. Yeah? Why do people get us upset when I sleep around? There's nothing wrong with it, as long as they don't find out. How dare they find out? They're not supposed to find out. I'm just expressing myself. Yeah? So, you know, we get in all these predicaments, and then we ask ourselves, why do I have problems? Well, you know, basically our mind is the source of our problems. Yeah. Can we turn the air on a little bit, the aircon on again? It's always too hot or too cold or too hot or too cold. So we'll just go on and off and on and off. Yeah. Yeah, all the women my age will understand. Okay, so, yeah, our polluted aggregates are unsatisfactory because they're under the control of afflictions and karma. Okay, so that's what that means. We don't have real freedom, do we? Yeah? I work with inmates in prison, and it's very interesting, you know, to ask them what freedom means. Yeah, because when you're in prison, you think freedom means, you know, being able to walk on the streets again and do what you want when you want to do it and stuff like that. It means not being locked up 23 hours a day and being able to get outside, you know, more than 1 hour, 3 times a week. Yeah. But, you know, the inmates who really get into the Dharma, they begin to see, actually, that that's not freedom. Being able to just go around on the streets and do what we want, that's not real freedom. Yeah. That our prison is a mental prison. Yeah. We're imprisoned by our afflictive emotions. Would you say you're imprisoned by your afflictive emotions? Yeah. When anger comes up, do you have any say so? Or does anger just like sweep you away? Now, it's difficult, isn't it? Yeah. When we're jealous, do we have much say so? Or again, you know, the emotion gets so strong, we're just like, it's just like a flood of energy pushing us. Okay? So we're not really free. No matter what the Declaration of Independence says. Yeah? Okay, the third one. The polluted aggregates are empty because of not being a permanent, unitary, and independent self. So the word emptiness has different meanings according to different philosophical tenet systems. So one meaning that is common to all the different Buddhist tenet systems is a self that is permanent, unitary, and independent. Okay? So this is a self or a soul that an Atman, like is taught in Hinduism, or a soul like is taught in Christianity and the theistic religions. Okay? So when we have the idea of a soul, it's something we think my soul, something permanent and unchanging, don't we? Yeah, it doesn't change moment to moment. It is me, always has been, always will be, never change. Yeah, and it's one thing. It's not something made of parts. You know, when we're little kids and we learn about, we're taught you have a soul. Yeah, it's one thing. There's one thing that's me, that's unchanging, and that doesn't depend on causes and conditions. A permanent soul, a permanent me, the essence of me-ness. Yeah. And we're taught that this exists while we're alive, and then this permanent, unchanging, independent soul, you know, picks up and, you know, if you're Hindu, it picks up and it goes into another body. If you're Christian, it leaves the body and it goes to heaven. And then you're with your relatives for all eternity. So, you know, is there such a soul like that? We may have been taught that when we were kids. But is it possible for something like that to really exist? When our body and mind are changing momentarily and not remaining the same, is it possible that there's something that is really me that is permanent and unchanging, that doesn't have parts, that doesn't depend on causes and conditions? What could that thing be and still be me and still not depend on my body and mind? Yeah. When we really analyze and ask ourselves, is it possible for that kind of self or soul to exist? We have to say, kind of difficult logically to assert the existence of that kind of self or soul. We may have been taught it, but just because we think it exists doesn't mean it exists. Yeah, it's actually the title of my book, Don't Believe Everything You Think. Okay. So that's one meaning of emptiness that all the different systems agree on, and especially here in the context of the Four Noble Truths. Okay. And then the fourth characteristic is the polluted aggregates are selfless because they lack a self-sufficient, substantially existent self. It's a mouthful. Self-sufficient, substantially existent self. I abbreviate it SSSE. Because if you're writing notes, it's too long. Okay? So this is another, there's different levels of fabricated selves that we believe in. The grossest level was the one we just talked about, the permanent, partless, independent one, the soul. This self-sufficient, substantially existent one is a little bit more subtle. This is the one that seems, it changes, yeah, but it's also the controller or the ruler of our body and mind. Do you have some sense of feeling of there being a me that tells your body what to do and a me that tells your mind what to do? Do you have that kind of sense inside? Yeah. There's this me that says, body, move your fingers. And then, you know, the body does like this. And then it says, you know, it says, body, don't eat chocolate ice cream. And body says, forget it. But we still feel like there's a controller in there. But we really can't control that much. Yeah. Our you know, the controller says, don't get angry. And the mind says, shut up. I want to be pissed off, I can be. Don't tell me what to do. It's kind of strange, isn't it? You know, like, who's this self that feels like it can boss the body and mind around, but actually doesn't have that much control? Yeah. I mean, we can't say to our body, stop your digestion. Yeah. Yeah. We don't have that kind of control. And you saw by doing the breathing meditation at the beginning of the session, yeah, wasn't it easy to just focus on your breath? Yeah. Okay. So this idea of some kind of self-sufficient, substantially existent person that's there, that's another fabricated self that we believe in, that we grasp onto. Yeah. And so this fourth condition is saying that, in fact, our body and mind are selfless in that they lack being or having some kind of self-sufficient, substantially existent controller self. Okay? We think that somewhere in the body and mind, there's that kind of self. Yeah. Or that maybe one of, you know, our body or our mind or something is that self. But when we examine, you know, is our body our self? Are your feelings yourself? Are your discriminations yourself? Yeah, when we go through the different aggregates, we see none of them are really me. Okay. I don't exist independent of them, but I'm also not them. Okay? So the polluted aggregates are selfless because they lack a self-sufficient, substantially existent self. Okay. So those are the first four of the 16. Let me pause right now and see if you have any questions or anything you want to talk about regarding what we've covered so far.
Never understood how emotions fit into the volitional factors, because to me volition means will.
Yeah.
But when I feel anger, I don't will to feel anger. It just comes up whooshing like a wave that knocks me over.
Right.
Before I even know I'm angry, I've flared out at somebody.
Yeah.
And then I go, oh, I'm experiencing anger.
Yeah.
Then it still doesn't make any difference. I still feel that sensation for several minutes afterwards before it passes away.
Yeah.
And I can't say, stop feeling anger. I know I'm angry, so stop feeling anger, because it physically it's there, that chemical change.
Right.
I have to stick with it until it goes away by itself.
Yeah. So you're saying how is that volitional? I think, yeah, when they're talking about volition here, it doesn't mean that we choose to be angry or we choose to be greedy. It means that greed and anger are the motivating factors for our actions. Okay? So it's like, I'm bad rapping somebody behind their back. Yeah, what is motivating that is resentment or jealousy or anger. So those are the volitional things that are affecting my intention. So that's what with the meaning of volition there. Yeah, well, it's like the volition is affecting the intention. Yeah, making the mind move, making the body and speech move in a direction.
It doesn't have to be consciously willful.
No. You know, in the sense of, you know, now I am choosing to be angry.
Yeah.
No. You know, I think if we look really subtle, there is a moment of choice in there. On a very subtle level, I think there is a moment of choice.
I'm not there anymore.
Yeah. But, you know, the volitional factors means that these are the things that motivate us to act.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other comments, questions? Nothing. Okay. Oh. Was there somebody? No. Okay. Then I'll go on. Okay. So now we're talking about the four attributes of true origins. So I already explained, you know, that this means ignorance, afflictions, and the karma, the polluted karma that it creates, okay? And so here, craving is an example of true origins. You know, you notice that when we did the true dukkha, that the five aggregates were the example, you know, the five aggregates are impermanent, the five aggregates are in the nature of dukkha, the five aggregates are empty, the five aggregates are selfless. So here the example is craving. Yeah, craving is the principal example of the cause or the origin of our dukkha. So why craving? You know, ignorance is the root. But why is craving? Yeah? Well, because when we look at our mind, most of the time we are craving something. Okay? We are craving not to be separated from pleasant things, aren't we? We are craving to be separated from unpleasant things. When everything's kind of neutral, we're craving for that not to change. Yeah. Our mind is constantly craving. It's wanting. There's this, the mind is sticky. Yeah. The mind doesn't just say something's there. It says, oh, that thing gives me pleasure. That thing gives me pain. That thing doesn't affect me. So therefore, I crave to have it. I crave to get rid of it. I crave for it not to change. Yeah. Always this craving. Yeah. Do you get what I mean? Do you have that sense inside? Yeah. The mind is never peaceful, is it? It's always wanting something. Yeah. And craving is also very, it's an important mental factor that comes on very strongly at the time of death. Okay? At the time of death, you know, we're separating from the body and mind. Yeah. The ignorance freaks out. Our ignorant mind freaks out. And says, if I don't have a body and mind, who am I going to be? So we crave. We crave not to be separated from the present body and mind. We crave to get a new body and mind. You know? And so this craving causes the karma to ripen. And when the karma ripens, then that throws us into whatever our next rebirth is going to be, because according to how the what we're craving for at the time of death, then certain karma ripens, and that makes a certain kind of rebirth appear very attractive to our mind, and the mind heads for that situation. Okay. So at the time of death, it isn't like, there's this soul that kind of floats above out of the body and sits on a cloud and looks down and says, who are my parents going to be? I'm taking interviews, applications. Who wants to be my parents? Oh, you? No, thank you. You? Well, yeah, maybe. It's not like that. Okay? Yeah? There's just the mind is craving, the mind is restless, the mind is wanting, an identity, wanting a body. And then that makes the karma ripen, and according to what karma ripens, we'll either be attracted, let's say, to a human body or an animal body or any other kind of body in the different realms. Okay? So that's, craving is very potent. Hmm? They always say, be careful what you want, you might get it. Okay, so if we look at the four attributes of true origins, craving and karma are the causes of dukkha because they are its root, and due to them, dukkha constantly exists. Okay, so when we contemplate this, craving and karma are the causes of our dukkha. It helps us see that our dukkha, whether it be all the unsatisfactory conditions, whether it's the dukkha of pain, dukkha of change, or dukkha of a pervasive conditioning, that all of that has causes. It doesn't just happen randomly or without causes. Okay. You know how when something bad happens, we always go, why me? Yeah, when we realize craving and karma are the causes because they are causes of dukkha because they are its root, and due to them, dukkha constantly exists. When we understand that, we don't say, why me? Because we know, why me? I have ignorance, so I have afflictions, so I acted out of that, and that created the cause for me to have this painful situation right now. So there's nobody else to blame. Yeah? The true source, the true origin of all my misery is inside here. Yeah. This is a big thing to understand, because we are constantly attributing the source of our misery to someone or something outside of ourselves. Aren't we? Why am I unhappy? Because my mother does this and my father does this. Why am I unhappy? Because my kids do that and they don't do this. Why am I unhappy? Well, because the government, forget it. The government doesn't work. That's why I'm unhappy. Our government doesn't work these days, does it? Yeah, when did it? Well, we had the illusion. I had the illusion before. When you're in like fifth grade, you have that illusion, there really is liberty and justice for all. And then you grow up and it's like, huh? So we always think, I have problems because of someone or something outside. And if only the external world changed, if only everybody listened to my wise advice and did what I wanted them to do when I wanted them to do it, then the world would be wonderful. Right? That's kind of how we live our life. We're always trying to get everybody and everything to do or be what we want them to do or be. And the world never cooperates with us. But we don't give up trying. We keep on trying to line up our duckies. I always have this image of, remember when you were a kid in the bathtub and you had your little plastic duckies? And you line up your little duckies. So in our life, we're always trying to line up our duckies, and you know, the pink one and the blue one, and get them the order we want. But then the duckies all move. Our little plastic duckies, yeah, don't go where we want them to go. And we get incredibly frustrated. Okay? So, here, this first one is helping us to understand that all of our dukkha, it doesn't arise spontaneously, randomly, without causes. Yeah, it arises due to causes that are within ourselves. Yeah, not due to other people. And when we see this, this actually has a very powerful effect, because it means you got to stop complaining. Can you imagine that? Stop complaining? What are we going to talk about all day? Huh? I have my PhD in complaining. You ever need a complaint, I can come up with one, or two, or 100, like this. Yeah? Because nothing is ever satisfactory. And, you know, so I spend a great deal of my life complaining. Do you? Huh? So when we really realize, yeah, that our suffering isn't random and causeless, and that the real cause is in here, then it means we got to stop complaining. Wow. Yeah, and not only stop complaining, we've got to accept responsibility for our own lives. Yeah, that we've got to say, why am I unhappy? Because of the choices I made. I'd much rather blame other people. Yeah, psychology taught me the first people I blame are my parents. That's why I'm so screwed up, because of my parents. But how do you ever become a good parent if all you do is blame your own parents? Mm-hmm. Okay, second one. Craving and karma are the origins of dukkha because they repeatedly produce all the diverse forms of dukkha. So afflictions and karma create not just a little bit of our problems and difficulties, but all of it. Okay. So understanding this dispels the idea that our unsatisfactory conditions come from only one cause, like your ex-husband or your ex-wife. No, I'm joking. Well, maybe not. But, you know, come from one cause, such as some primal substance or something like this. People have all sorts of different philosophical ideas of, you know, the cause of their misery. And so instead, things actually depend on not just one cause, but on many causes and many conditions, don't they? Yeah, for a plant to grow, you don't need just the seed. You need the water, the fertilizer, the sunshine. You need a lot of factors. So in the same way, for our suffering to happen, for our happiness to happen, it depends on many causes and conditions, many factors, not just one. Okay, multiple. Okay, I'll go through quickly through the other two. So at least we'll finish two of the four noble truths. Craving and karma are strong producers because they act forcefully to produce strong dukkha, strong unsatisfactory conditions. Okay, so understanding this dispels the notion that our dukkha, our unsatisfactory conditions, arise from discordant causes. In other words, such as things like an external creator. Yeah. And many people think when they have problems, it's God's will. Yeah, you hear this all the time, don't you? Yeah, this child died. Why? It's God's will. Oh my goodness. Yeah. God doesn't sound like a very nice guy, does he? Hmm? So this noticing that craving and karma are strong producers because they act forcefully to produce all of our unsatisfactory conditions helps us to understand that our misery is not due to some kind of external creator who manipulates us like puppets, who makes things happen or makes things not happen in our life. But instead, our own mind, our own craving, our ignorance, our afflictions, our karma, these are the things that make, that form our experience. Yeah, like I was saying before, whenever something bad happens, we say, why me? Whenever something good happens, we never say, why me? Yeah, but we should say, why me? Yeah, why do I have enough to eat today? Why do I have friends? Why do I have the fortune to come to Dharma teachings? Yeah, because I created some kind of virtuous actions in the past. Yeah. They were still influenced by ignorance because I still didn't have the, you know, understanding of how things actually exist. But I still, you know, had virtuous mental states and created many good causes because I have many favorable conditions in my life right now. And those things, the favorable conditions, didn't happen by chance. They didn't happen because of some, you know, substance that permeates everything. They didn't happen because of some external force like a creator God. Yeah. Those are good circumstances I experienced came out of my own actions. Yeah. My own virtuous intentions. Okay. And then the fourth one, craving and karma are conditions because they act as the cooperative conditions giving rise to dukkha. Okay? So understanding that our dukkha depends on both causes and conditions, the seed plus the water and, you know, fertilizer and stuff, dispels the notion that our dukkha is fixed and unalterable. Okay? And this is an important thing because often when we experience very gross suffering, we feel like our suffering is fixed and unalterable, don't we? Yeah. When our feelings are hurt and we feel a lot of mental pain, do we think, oh, this is going to change and pass away? That idea in your mind? Yeah. When you feel depressed, do you think, oh, this is just a passing mental state? Mm-hmm. No. We make everything so heavy, so solid, so concrete. Okay? We feel like things just can't change. And we kind of give up on ourselves and give up on other people. And actually, when we understand this, that craving and karma are conditions because they act as the cooperative conditions for our unsatisfactory circumstances. We begin to see that because things depend on causes and conditions, if you change either the cause or any of the conditions, the result has to change. Okay, so this can be really helpful. You know, especially in family situations, when you feel like there's this family dynamic that is just cast in concrete and it's totally dysfunctional. Do you ever have that feeling? Yeah? It's like I've tried everything to change this family dynamic and it can't change. That's a wrong conception. Yeah, we have that conception because we don't see that things depend on causes and conditions. And if you change any of the conditions in that family dynamic, the whole thing changes. Yeah. If we stop playing our role, other people cannot continue playing their role. But that's the challenge to us, is for us to stop playing our role. Because we're very habituated and very stuck in our role in the family dynamic, and we want other people to change without us changing. Yeah, you change first, then I will. Mm-mm. I change first. But I don't know how to change. I don't know that I want to change. If I change, who am I going to be? You mean I have to be nice to my brother? Yeah, or whoever it is. Yeah, so we have to understand that things depend on causes and conditions. And so therefore, if we change even one circumstance, the whole thing has got to change. Okay. So we finished two of the Four Noble Truths. Wow, we're halfway there. So we did the you know, the unsatisfactoriness and its causes, and tomorrow we get liberation and its causes. Okay, so that's the carrot. You got to come back tomorrow morning. You can't just, you know, kind of jump ship tonight. Tomorrow's the good stuff. Yeah, the light and love and bliss is coming tomorrow. Hey, any other questions people might have? Anything? Yeah.
Would you repeat the second one for the second noble truth?
Please? Okay, the second one for the second noble truth.
Thank you.
Craving and karma are origins of dukkha because they repeatedly produce all the diverse forms of dukkha. Okay. Maybe I should give a little sneak preview commercial. What I'm teaching from is a chapter from a book that His Holiness is doing that will come out hopefully sometime soon by Wisdom Publications. So that's the sneak preview. Yes.
Do you mean karma there, the habitual karmic force, or do you mean something else? Could you clarify a little bit about karma?
Oh, okay. So what I mean by karma is action. Yeah? Volitional action. So it can be either mental action, you know, by which we're planning something. It can be verbal action, how we communicate. Yeah? Or it can be physical action. So karma is nothing mystical and magical. It just means the actions we do with our body, speech, and mind. Okay? And we're acting all the time. And we have intentions for these actions. And according to the kind of intention we have, then the action becomes virtuous, non-virtuous, or neutral. You know, or wholesome, unwholesome, or neutral. Okay, and when an action finishes, it leaves some, we could say, for lack of a better expression, although this isn't totally accurate, some residual energy. It leaves some kind of trace. Okay, the fact that the action happened is important. Yeah, and that having happened of the action is going to propel something else to happen in the future. Okay? So that's why it's not that we just act and then, you know, the only effects of our action are what comes in the next 5 minutes. Yeah? But the effects of our actions can happen later this life. They can happen in future lives. I mean, we know that even on a practical level. Yeah. Let's say you don't file your income tax. It isn't that the result of that happens in the next 5 minutes. The result may happen later on. Yeah. But there's going to be a result. Okay.
Also, that included mindful choice and action. So that is included in this context, or?
Oh, okay. Yeah. Karma can also include mindful chosen action, you know, for coming from a virtuous motivation. Here, what's happening is there's still ignorance present because we still see things as independent, as external, objectively existent, but we relate to them in a virtuous way. So there may be a thought of, I want to be generous. I want to give something. Or, here's the opportunity to help somebody. I want to be kind. Or, this person needs encouragement. I can give some encouragement. Yeah. So karma also can refer to our virtuous actions that create the cause of happiness, but within samsara. Okay, so this is polluted karma in the sense that it creates happiness within cyclic existence. To have the happiness of nirvana, then we need unpolluted karma that isn't affected by this ignorance that misapprehends reality. Does that answer your question okay? Yeah, but mindful, yeah, chosen action, I mean, that's certainly the beginning of the path for us, isn't it? Instead of just acting on automatic, you know, under the influence of whatever idea pops in our mind, to step back and have some space. You know, oh, that idea came, and now let's assess. Well, you know, what's the value of acting that out? What's the value of not? Yeah. And then making wise decisions in our life. Okay. So that's it for this evening. Come back tomorrow morning. Okay. But in the meantime, you know, think a little bit about what we talked about. Okay? Yeah. Then you want to do the verses?
The white herb and go to the back of the first bay sheet. Or should we do this? No, okay. Where it says dedication prayers. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel bodhicitta that has not arisen arise and grow, and may that which has arisen not diminish but increase more and more. Just as the brave Manjushri and Samantabhadra too, realizing this they are, also I dedicate all these merits in the best way that I may follow their perfect example. I dedicate all these roots of virtue with a dedication praises the best by the victorious one that's gone of the three times, so that I might perform the noble bodhisattva deeds. In the land encircled by snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good, all-powerful Chenrezig Tenzin Gyatso. Please remain until samsara ends. Savior of the snowland teachings and transmigratory beings, who extensively clarifies a path that unifies emptiness and compassion, to the lotus in the hand, Lord Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech, may all your holy wishes be fulfilled. The one who masters speech at a very young age, the one with great patience who received the name Avatara, the one with great precision who spread the teachings of Rama Tsongkhapa on bliss and void, Lama ornament of the yellow hat tradition, please remain until samsara ends. You will uphold the subduer's moral way, who serve as a bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjana's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplished magnificent prayers honoring the three jewels, savior of myself and yours, disciples. Please, please live on.